Well, good morning. Could someone, an outline, remind me what my scripture reading is supposed to be? Or the bulletin? Ezra 10, 5 through 9. All right. Team effort. Let's go ahead and turn over to the book of Ezra together in chapter 10. We'll start reading in verse 9, or chapter 10, verse 5. My apologies. Then Ezra arose and made the leading priests, the Levites, and all Israel swear on an oath that they would do according to this word. So they swore an oath. Then Ezra arose from before the house of God and went into the chamber of Jehohanan, the son of Eliashib. He went there, but he did not eat bread nor drink water, for he was mourning over the unfaithfulness of the exiles. And they made a proclamation throughout Judah and Jerusalem to all the exiles that they should gather at Jerusalem, and that whoever would not come within 3 days, according to the counsel of the prince and the elders, all his possessions should be devoted to destruction, and he himself separated from the assembly of the exiles. So all the men of Judah and Benjamin gathered at Jerusalem within the 3 days. It was the 9th month of the 20th month, and all the people sat in the open square before the house of God, trembling because of this matter and the heavy rain. Let's pause there for a moment. Again, I want to, as we get started, welcome everyone to be out this morning. So many have already commented on what a wonderful day it is, and I just want to give my hearty amen to that. It is always a great grace. It is always a privilege to get to be with God's people, to open up His Word together, and encourage and lift each other up in our worship. You can be turning to the book of Malachi and chapter 2. Malachi chapter 2, we will be there in just a few moments. If you picked up a copy of the outline in the back, you know that this is the first in a series of lessons that we're going to start this morning. And as you're turning there, just a little bit of context about why it's important to look at these things and sort of the frame of mind that I'm taking into the study this month. But I'm going to start with a story that, if it wasn't so serious, would be comical. Yesterday, Summer and I were given sort of a life update on a mutual friend, a lady who had been friends with a gentleman, and things were perhaps teetering towards a little bit more seriousness in their relationship, and she knew that he had been married twice, and that those two marriages had come to an end because of the result of scriptural reasons. But then he was compelled to admit that he had actually been married a third and a fourth time, and those were not marriages that had ended in a scriptural way. And you know, as this story was unfolding, I felt like this might be the long-lost cousin of the woman at the well in John 4. I didn't know how high the number was going to go. And you know, that kind of a story, when we're talking about Christians, we might be somewhat surprised by that, and yet at the same time, I think that those kinds of stories are almost losing their ability to shock us anymore, that we kind of say, well, you know, that's unfortunate, and I wish that wasn't the case, but that is, you know, you're hearing about that more and more. You know, it was not too long ago when Larry King, what did he get up to? 12 or 13 marriages? But, you know, that was just an astronomical figure. He was used as a caricature of the problem of divorce. And yet now it's really not anything to find somebody who has at least got half of his kind of numbers. And so I'm not telling you anything that you don't already know. Many of you have seen this coming for a long time, and as with most things, it probably goes in cycles, but I can't say that I remember, but I have been told that my mother's first words to me when I was born were marry a faithful Christian and don't ever divorce. And that was a reflection of a situation that was going on at the work where Dad was preaching at the time. But regardless of circumstances, that was pretty good advice and something I have done my best to follow. So we're going to be looking over this month not just at, the rules and regulations about marriage, but I want to try to approach this from a whole view of what does God really have in mind for marriage? Because I don't think we can really talk about issues pertaining to the terrible circumstances under which a marriage might end if we don't first really comprehend what God desires for marriage in the first place. So in Ezra chapter 10 that we read from a moment ago, that passage, as you might recall, is given within the context of some marriages that were about to come to an end. And what has always really stuck with me in that text is what we find at the latter half of verse 9, where, you know, the writer, I think, is doing more than just giving us the weather forecast for the day. It is a reflection of the occasion. It is a reflection of the somber and reverent tone with which this grave issue was being approached, that they set before the house of God. They were trembling because of this matter and the heavy rain. This is a dark day. And there's really nothing lighthearted about, you know, even reliving that day. This is not a fun study. I mention the text not because I want our hearts necessarily to tremble, but because that is the seriousness with which we need to be approaching any type of study about the bonds of the marriage relationship. But as I've said, I think we have to lay a foundation, some just basic principles about how God sees these issues. And we're going to start in Malachi chapter 2. Now, as you may recall, Malachi is doing his work concurrently with men like Ezra and Nehemiah. And usually we talk about Ezra and Nehemiah within the context of their physical rebuilding projects, that they've got to rebuild the wall, they've got to finish up the temple, those kinds of things. And yet the rebuilding that was taking place under those and other men was really something that went far past just those physical structures. There was the rebuilding of a spiritual conscience for a nation. There was a rebuilding of a relationship that had been just shattered between a people and their God. And so one of the things that they had to deal with, both Ezra and Nehemiah, is that they come and they're getting in the midst of God's people, and they find that God's people have been unfaithful in one of the core tenets of what made them part of Israel. They had gone and they had joined themselves in marriage to foreigners. And Malachi chapter 2 and verse 11 in particular seems to indicate that the context within which this prophecy took place was that you have the men of Judah, they're not only marrying foreign women, but they are unlawfully putting away and forsaking the marriages that they had already entered into, and then on top of that, were going out and marrying women of the land. And so Malachi's prophecy is intended to be just this incredibly strong rebuke from the Lord about their failures to live up to some of the basic purposes of the marriage relationship. I want us to read this whole section just to get a little bit of context. I think we're all familiar with verse 16. But let's start in verse 10, and we'll read verses 10 through 16. Do we not all have one Father? Has not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously, each against his brothers, so as to profane the covenant of our fathers? Judah has dealt treacherously, and an abomination has been done in Israel and in Jerusalem. For Judah has profaned the sanctuary of Yahweh, which he loves, and has married the daughter of a foreign god. And as for the man who does this, may Yahweh cut off from the tents of Jacob everyone who awakes and answers or who presents an offering to Yahweh of hosts. And this is a second thing you do. You cover the altar of Yahweh with tears, with weeping, and with groaning, because he no longer regards the offering or receives it as acceptable from your hand. But you say, for what reason? Because Yahweh has been a witness between you and the wife of your youth, against whom you have dealt treacherously, though she is your companion and your wife by covenant. But not one has done so, even one who has a remnant of the Spirit. And what did that one do while he was seeking a godly seed? Be careful then to keep your spirit, and let no one deal treacherously against the wife of your youth. For I hate divorce, says Yahweh, the God of Israel, and him who covers his garment with wrong, says Yahweh of hosts. Be careful then to keep your spirit, that you do not deal treacherously. Let's pause there in the text and just try and make a few observations from what God is saying is happening because of their approach to their marriages. And one of the first things that we ought to notice in verse 13 is that their actions have erected a barrier between themselves and God. The immediate consequence of every man who had forsaken the wife of his youth and joined himself to the daughter of a foreign god was that now they found themselves with a gulf fixed between them and the Lord. I think the implication of the verses here, you see the reference to the tears covering the altar of God. I don't think that this is a picture of the people are frustrated, God is not listening to me, and so now I'm sad and I'm crying at the altar. Rather, I believe the implication seems to be is that the tears that are covering the altar are coming from all of these wives who have been abandoned and forsaken by their husbands. And so what does God see whenever someone comes to the altar and tries to present an offering to him? He doesn't see someone who is bringing worship to him. What he sees is someone who has acted treacherously toward their spouse. And so in this context, the first thing that they have done by dealing with their wives in such a way was to separate themselves from God. He says in verse 14, you have become treacherous, or you have acted treacherously. Your translation might have something along the lines of you've been unfaithful, which is a perfectly fine thing to have in there, except for the fact that I think it sort of undercuts the severity of what's being said in the text. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying being unfaithful is not a big deal. I think that's implied in the term treacherous. But unfaithful is, again, it's so common, it's almost a flippant term. The idea of treachery here is meant to convey a sense of violence, that something violent has occurred, that here you have committed an act of betrayal that has taken away someone's sense of peace and security. If you can imagine that you were to come home from our worship service today and you open up the door to your home, a place that is supposed to be peace and quiet, and you find that you've been robbed, you've been ransacked, your peace, your sense of security and belonging has been taken away from you because someone, your neighbor, has acted treacherously. Well, this is what God is describing in these marriages that have been torn apart. You have acted treacherously. You have betrayed someone. You have acted toward them with violence. Verse 15 reminds them that in doing so, they were really abandoning the purpose of their marriage. I want to read this verse three more times. I have a couple of different translations for hopefully some clarity. This is one of the more difficult texts to translate. The ESV renders it, "Did he not make them one with a portion of the Spirit in their union? And what was the one God seeking? Godly offspring. So guard yourselves and your spirit, and let none of you be faithless to the wife of your youth." A couple of the modern English translations. "But did he not make them one, having a remnant of the Spirit? And why one? He seeks godly offspring. Therefore, take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously with the wife of his youth." And one more, "Has not the one God made you? You belong to him in body and spirit. And what does the one God seek? Godly offspring. So be on your guard, and do not be unfaithful to the wife of your youth." What the prophet is doing here is reminding them that God had a purpose and a design for marriage. And it wasn't to simply go off, as in the case of these men, and find, you know, the most attractive or most beneficial wife that they could do, regardless of their background or their culture, and regardless of how it was going to affect their children. What God had in mind was for them to seek out someone who shared their faith, so that their marriage could be completely united in flesh and in spirit, and then to result in children, and more specifically, to result in children that would grow up to be God-fearing people. It is a worship-propagating machine, the family, that two people who are joined in the Spirit with God produce more people who in turn are raised and taught to worship God. That is the point of marriage. And by forsaking this, following their fleshly desires, they had not only turned their backs on it, but now they were producing children who would not be godly offspring. And so God's assessment is that not only have you done all of these other things, but if you have done this, you do not even possess a remnant of my spirit. That is how seriously God takes a violation, an abandonment of the vows that we have made to each other. If you do this, you do not have a remnant of my spirit. Almost as an afterthought, I don't mean to treat it that way, but at least twice in the text, Yahweh of hosts is invoked. We mentioned this a couple of weeks ago when we were finishing out 1 Peter. The image, the name of God, invoking him as the captain, the Lord of this heavenly army, is so often brought to bear against those who are filled with pride and those who mistreat the unfortunate and the helpless. And so when a husband casts out his wife in order to pursue his fleshly desires, it is again sending up a signal flare for God to rally his forces against that man. Now, what does this mean for us? Well, first of all, I think that we would very obviously say that that is not the way in which our culture discusses this topic. This isn't the way that people talk about divorce. But it is the attitude that we have to take in to any study that deals with either divorce or marriage. The way that God sees the sundering of that union. And it is extremely helpful and important for us to have this in mind as we enter into our next text of Matthew chapter 19. Turn with me, if you would, to Matthew the 19th chapter. And in just a moment, we're going to read the first 10 verses. Now, what we're going to find in the text is that Jesus is going to be setting what we can think of as the baseline parameters for marriage, the foundational principles for not only the separation, if that takes place, but really, again, what marriage is supposed to be about. Now, we find ourselves in the time of Jesus, and there isn't a lot of change from the time of Malachi to the time of Christ, or even to our day today. There's a very casual attitude toward divorce. The Pharisees are hoping to cash in on this controversy. Now, just as a side point, a lot of people try to make this text far more complicated than it is, to posit this as though this question was the most urgent, pressing need of the day, and we've got to do all this research in order to really understand what the text is about. But that's just so silly in light of how many issues the Pharisees tried to pull Jesus into. This is one of many. They were arguing about everything. Jesus, what do you think about paying taxes? Jesus, what do you think about working on the Sabbath? What do you think about marriage and the afterlife? Any opportunity would do, but these were all hot-button issues. The Pharisees are trying to cash in on a controversy. Which side do you take? Because in taking sides, one way or another, you're going to make someone upset. Well, I don't think that anybody really expected the answer that Jesus winds up giving, because, of course, he's not seeking to please people with the answer he gives. He's just going to tell what the will of the Father is. So in Matthew chapter 19, and beginning in verse 1, "Now it happened that when Jesus had finished these words, he departed from Galilee and came into the region of Judea beyond the Jordan. And large crowds followed him, and he healed them there. And some Pharisees came to Jesus, testing him and saying, 'Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all?' And he answered and said, 'Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And said, "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate.' They said to him, 'Why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away?' And he said to them, 'Because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it has not been this way. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another woman, commits adultery.' The disciples said to him, 'If the relationship of the man with his wife is like this, it is better not to marry.' But he said to them, 'Not all men can accept this statement, but only those to whom it has been given. For there are eunuchs who were born that way from their mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men, and there are also eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. He who is able to accept this, let him accept this.'" Again, let's pause in our text and try to draw out a few observations. But I think that the first thing that we really ought to take from the passage is in verse 6, and that is, divorce is not a creation of God. Divorce does not originate from God. Sometimes we look at difficult passages or difficult matters and we make the mistake of thinking that because God has regulated something, that God was the inventor of that something. And yet we find that that is not true with any number of things. God did not invent murder. But because man invented murder, he had to set punishments and parameters for, if a life is taken in this way, this is what will happen. If a life is taken in this way, this is what will happen. That does not mean that because God has set parameters for what you do in that situation, that he is somehow looking positively on that situation. The same thing can be said about slavery in the Old Testament. If you have a slave, this is how you must treat them, and this is when you must set them free. If you loan somebody money, this is what you have to do. All sorts of issues that came from the mind of men that God had to step in and say, this is what you have to do now that you've started doing these things. God invented marriage. Man invented divorce. The regulation that God allowed under the law of Moses was not because of God's pleasure. It was because of the hardness of the hearts of the people. Divorce, even in a bad situation, is not what God desires. Now, I'm going to qualify that in a few ways, but again, I think it is an important baseline piece of information for us to understand. And I'll say it again. Even when a situation is bad, God does not desire automatically that that marriage ought to end. The context in which God speaks in Malachi, again, is one of divorce. And his assessment is that he hates it. I realize that there are some more modern translations that alter that slightly, and whoever divorces his wife covers his garment with violence. I don't think that we would say, well, God doesn't hate divorce. He just sees it as you covering your garment with violence towards your wife. So it's, you know, it's not that big of a deal. God hates divorce regardless of how you try to translate that text. God is not happy and pleased even when the situation is in verse 9. Now, understand, I am not insinuating that God is displeased with the individual who understands, what Christ has said and has tried to salvage that relationship, but because of the immorality of their spouse, that marriage ends. Not saying that God is displeased with that person. But neither does it make God happy that a marriage relationship fell apart. It certainly doesn't make God happy that at least one half of that relationship dealt treacherously with their spouse. Whenever a marriage comes to an end, it is a tragedy. There is no positive circumstance, no happy circumstance that spells the end of a marriage. God's preference, I believe the text teaches, is for the marriage, if at all possible, to stay together even in difficulty. Consider the way that this teaching is laid out. In Mark chapter 10 and verse 9, there is no exception given for divorce leading to remarriage. In Luke chapter 16 and verse 18, and let me rephrase that. There is no exception given for divorce. In Luke 16 and verse 18, there is no exception for divorce. In Matthew chapter 19, there is no exception for divorce in Jesus' first answer. So the point I'm making is this. Consider the context under which Jesus eventually gives some type of exception. He says, first of all, marriage is from the beginning. And from the beginning, it has been permanent. Do not separate. And so three times in the Gospels, he says, do not divorce, do not divorce, do not divorce. Then, after emphasizing that three times, he gives the smallest, most narrow of exceptions. And again, some people, when they see that exception, they want to try and pry into it and see if we can just kind of stretch this open a little bit more, and maybe we can sort of extrapolate from that. You know, if we read more, if we knew more, if we had all this first century knowledge. But the reason that I know that that exception is every bit as narrow as Jesus made it sound is because the disciples come up and they say, well, if those are the rules about marriage, then it's better not to even get married in the first place. And then notice that Jesus does not say to them, well, you know, hold on, I think you must have misunderstood me. No, he just says, yeah, that's how it is. Take it or leave it. This is hard. This is a difficult saying. I think you understand I'm being a little glib, and when I say take it or leave it, I don't mean that we really have the choice. He's just saying, here's what it is. Let him who has ears, let him hear. What you do with it is up to you, whether you're going to obey or not. Again, I think that that is an extremely important point to make when we consider our approach to talking about marriage. Again, this isn't an indictment of anyone. I'm indicting myself. But when we are speaking about divorce and the most common conversations, what is usually the big question? Do I have a what? Do I have a right? Did this person have a right? You know, it has only been in recent years where it occurred to me that this is simply a bizarre way to word a question. God says, I hate this thing. And my response is, but do I have a right to do it, though? Do I have a right to do the thing that God says he hates? And I think that that reveals somewhat an underlying problem with the way that perhaps I've sometimes approached that issue, and reveals that I'm not always thinking about those baseline ideas that God has set in place when it comes to issues of marriage and, if it comes to it, divorce. Again, I'm well aware of our exception in verse 9, and I'm well aware that this is something that requires the willingness of two people. And we'll talk about that more in coming weeks. But what we need to see is that the weight of these passages is not on what are the circumstances under which a marriage can end. The weight is placed on don't seek to end a marriage at all. Again, we'll explore this more. That is not denying the fact that Jesus absolutely does give an exception in this text. But an exception is what? It's an exception. It's the rarity. It's supposed to be something that is outside the norm. And yet, as divorce, even in the church, runs rampant, so many marriages are quick to end almost immediately, and it is backed up with, well, I had a right. I had a right to do this. Well, I'm gonna get on a tangent there, so let me recombobulate myself. And I think we can go on to our next point. I want us to deal with sort of a catch-all category of what I believe, again, are some fairly common attitudes toward this discussion. And again, the first attitude is that we categorize it as something that we are entitled to. I have quoted G.K. Chesterton before in saying that the problem with cheap divorce is that it leads to cheap marriages. And whether or not it is said out loud, things like no-fault divorce allow people to consider divorce to be the eject button on their marriage. And I would argue that that is the case even in the midst of Christians who would even think, if it comes down to it, somehow we can arrange this so that one of us is unfaithful. And we'll talk about this more in just a minute. But maybe I can set things up so that my spouse will be unfaithful. Maybe I can push them in that direction. Divorce is not a punchline. It's not funny. It doesn't need to be a joke. It doesn't need to be said in jest. It doesn't need to be spoken in our houses, in our homes, in front of our children, to each other. Divorce is brandished so often as though it were a weapon. It was a threat to bend the other individual to our will. And yet, that should never be a concern on our minds. Do you ever get into arguments with your spouse? I see a lot of people working on that New Year's resolution of honesty. I had a disagreement with my spouse last night. Our dishwasher was on the fritz. And we ordered the part, and we had the part, and by mutual agreement, we agreed not to install the part so that other members of our household could work on their work ethic in washing dishes. Yesterday, a full day, I said, I'm going to install that part today. Yesterday was a full day. Last night I got home, I put the girls in bed, and then it was time to put me in bed. Had on my nighttime apparel, climbed into my bed underneath my heavy blankets, and then a sweet angelic voice came through the door. Are you going to put in that dishwasher part today? Well, I was thinking tomorrow. Oh. Well, I guess I'll do it. I said, well, you don't know what you're doing. You're going to electrocute yourself. I don't even have the tools in the house. It's okay. I'll go do it. And do you know what I said? I said two words. One of them was a compound. You're ridiculous. And I went and I got that drill and I fixed the dishwasher. But I will tell you, at no point in that or any other altercation did I ever imagine, if I don't do this, my wife is going to threaten me with divorce. In any altercation that we've ever had, I don't think she has ever had it cross her mind, well, he's so mad, this might be it. We're going to get divorced. And the reason why that is the furthest thought from our mind is because it is a foreign word. It is not spoken, even in jest. And so it could never be something that floats to the top as a possibility. We have to work on attitudes that see things that are harmful and hurtful as an entitlement. On the other end of that spectrum, though, we have to realize and recognize that there are people who suffer because of the sinful actions of another. And Jesus recognizes that in the text. It is the slim exemption that he gives. And unfortunately, while I hesitate to throw around terms like legalism, the discussion of divorce has often been, it's not reduced to, but built up into being some sort of complex legal code filled with questions like, well, did you get to the courthouse before they did? What's the timestamp on your paperwork? Did yours go through quicker? Did you file immediately? Because heaven forbid that you actually think about reconciling and trying to work things through. I mean, you got to get there quick. We got to make sure that this thing is for adultery. And, you know, if you don't get in the car and go 90 miles an hour to fill out those papers immediately, then you're not following what Jesus said. Did you countersue? What did you put on your paperwork? Again, there are a lot of different directions that we can go where we take something where Jesus has said, don't divorce unless this one instance, and that's all I have to say about it. Well, but what about this? What about this? Don't divorce unless it's for this issue. But again, sometimes things are just too simple for us, and so we want to try and bend things as uncomfortable and contorted as we can. I would also warn against the forming of parties, which is such an awful thing. You know, Alexander gave a good example this morning of discernment, of an eldership that has to figure out what to do with an abusive parent. And I think that the natural inclination would be that we tie the abusive parent to a tree and beat him with a hose pipe and leave him there. And when someone has been unfaithful, well, that would be my temptation too. What are you thinking, doing this to your spouse, to your family? And so we generally divide ourselves between good guys and bad guys, the innocent and the guilty, and the idea of trying to either salvage the situation or salvage the spiritual relationship with everyone is very quickly going out the window. You know, the men, if it's, well, it really isn't even a matter of innocent or guilty to throw those terms. The men will often flock to the men and be understanding, and the women will flock to the women and try to, you know, exacerbate that situation on both sides. And yet, I read a passage like 1 Corinthians 7, verses 3 through 5. And please understand what I'm saying. I'm not victim blaming or victim shaming or any other pejorative viction adverbs. But in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 3, the husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does, and likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Now, you know, as well as I do, that there are sham divorces that have taken place because a spouse deprived the other spouse. And what happened was exactly what Paul said would happen. Someone was tempted, they lost self-control, but by the technicality of all technicalities, they were unfaithful. I've got the right to put them away. I've got the right to remarry. Well, did you set them up? Did you deprive one another so that someone was overcome by the tempter? Well, yeah, but you know, I ask forgiveness of that. And the important thing is, they committed adultery. Now, that's not an exaggeration. I believe, if I know of situations like that, we've got common experiences. Surely you know of situations like that. That's one example. But my point is that it is, we see this in every situation. I'm dealing with my children. She pushed me. Okay, that's bad. What were you doing? I may have been pulling her hair. Well, when you set out to pull her hair, did you consider the fact that you might get pushed? I think part of the shame when we rush to separate instead of rush to reconcile is that it overlooks that in any point of conflict, there is probably some degree of fault on both sides. Now, that's not to say every point of conflict. Again, there are people who are rascals and fiends, and they have no disregard for, or they have no regard for God or man, and they are treacherous with their spouse. There's never been a vow or a commitment they've made that they have honored. And yet too often in a self-driven, self-centered society, and our rush to take sides and our rush to conform to some imaginary, complex legal tango, we bypass the good of both souls. Now, I've kept you long enough. You've got black-eyed peas and collards waiting, I assume. So we'll wrap up there for now. But if I could beg your patience for just a moment longer, I want us to try and take at least a couple of these thoughts with us. Well, I always talk about taking things into the week ahead, but if we can kind of preserve these as we continue to study this. You know, we talk a lot about comparing the way that we approach an issue with the way that God approaches an issue, and recognizing when there's a discrepancy that there's some way in which we have been infiltrated or influenced by the world. And this is certainly one of those areas. I think we have got, Christians everywhere have simply got to look at the way they have approached the issue of divorce, the pattern that they have set for children who are watching with issues of divorce, and ask whether or not this lines up with God's attitude of permanency, of seeking to salvage and restore, and only within the most narrow confines does this come to an end. Or if we've reversed that to where we start off looking for reasons, or we retroactively look back and find reasons. And I think what Matthew 19:10 ought to remind us of is that we really ought to stop looking. If this is the way that it is with a man with his wife, it's better not to marry. Yeah, that's right. It's hard. It's not for everybody. Maybe you don't need to get married. It's a very narrow gap. Exceptions don't have branches of exceptions. And when we're continually trying to look, to justify looking forward, looking back, I think we've lost sight of God's purpose for marriage, and we've opened up ourselves to influence by the world. Now, this has not been a lesson where we've spent really any time talking about an invitation or anything that might point us there, other than the fact that we know that God's will extends beyond just our marriages. His wisdom for what will be good and what will not cause hurt extends to every part of our lives. And that begins with approaching Him for salvation from our sins. And so we have that opportunity offered now and offered anytime it's convenient. If you need to be baptized this morning, if that's something that you've already done, you want prayers, you want encouragement, we're always glad to offer them. So if we can help you this morning, you have an opportunity to let that be known while we stand and sing together.